Welcome everyone to Street and Curb. And yes, we are still playing turn from the birds because we're still talking election. It took 4 years to get to this point with the election. I think we can spend a couple weeks still talking about it. So I am your driver or designated driver for Street and Curb. I'm your host, Steve Carvelli. Welcome everyone to our street. And what do we do with the street? We talk politics, economics. We have information, not disinformation. We try to dispel that, but we have information. We talk about science, psychology, and anything else that can be driven on the street. The street is really expanding. Right now, we're on radio channels in Florida, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Alabama. We're soon to be adding Mississippi. So we have a lot going on the street. We'll give you the details as they come along. The street wants to be your source for critical thinking. It's critical thinking that's needed for today's issues. We aren't mainstream. We aren't mainstream media, but we are the street. And we're nothing but the street. And hopefully we can give you some street smarts to really decipher what's going on in today's media, what's going on in this country, and what's going on possibly in our future. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. And we have a full show today, but we'll take a quick break right now.
Paul Oster, certified FICO Pro, the nation's credit repairman, and the president of Better Qualified. 20 years of helping thousands of people repair their credit. We have an A rating with the Better Business Bureau, and our clients have saved thousands of dollars with lower interest rates. Text the message CURB to the number 40691. Again, text the message CURB to the number 40691 to get your free credit analysis.
Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curb, and boy, do we have a full show for you today. We still got some post-election hangover to get over, so I guess I'll go through that a little bit. One of the things is that we have to talk about is the initial look ahead post-Biden, what the new President Trump will possibly do. And we have to discuss some of the critical thinking theories that have been popping up on post-election commentary by mainstream media about what went wrong for their party, what went wrong for their candidates. So we do have a full schedule and plate today for Street and Curb. So let's get right into it. You know, it's interesting that one of the things is that's getting a lot of talk about, and whether it's true or not, I'm kind of suspect. But we're going to talk about it here anyway, because it's kind of interesting about endorsements for hire. And, you know, I'm really talking about endorsements for hire that are on the Democratic side. You know, whether Elon Musk is an endorsement for hire on the Trump side, we really don't know what the connection is, except he's heading a new division of a new department of government that is really aimed to eliminate government or eliminate some divisions of government. So that's an interesting hypocrisy that we can discuss later. But let's talk about some of the endorsements that have been bandied about that supposedly were paid by the Harris camp for endorsements. Number one, there was supposedly $5 million paid to Megan Thee Stallion, $3 million paid to Lizzo, $1.8 million paid for Eminem, and $1 million paid for Oprah. Now, there is a denial from some of these recipients. And matter of fact, the Oprah payment actually went to Harpo Productions, which is her company. It's actually her name spelled backward. And it was paid for some logistical work and didn't go directly to her. So I'm not sure the mechanics of all these payments were paid directly to these celebrities or if they were paid to their affiliated companies for other types of sources. But whatever the case may be, it's something that we need to address, that whether a candidate should pay for a celebrity endorsement. Now, some of these celebrity endorsements do have advertising and marketing companies that they control, and the payment can be made to them. Whatever the case, it's still some payment that benefits the celebrity for endorsing them. So in other words, is this correct? Is this something that should be done? Well, you know, I'm going to throw my name out there for the next election cycle. I was born and brought up and continue to happily occupy a solidly middle-class space in America. So my endorsement will be much cheaper than these celebrity endorsements. I'll have 4 years really to tone my craft here on Street and Curb, and I'll probably only ask for about $1,000 for my endorsement. But if celebrities can get that $1 million price tag on their endorsement, I think my $1,000 in 4 years would come relatively cheap. Now, I can't sing, and I don't know if Beyonce endorsed Camilla but didn't sing at a concert, so I don't know if her payment went through or not. But I think we need to address celebrity endorsements, how relative they are, how relevant they are and how relative they are to the cost. In other words, do people like Beyonce command a lot more than Lizzo on an endorsement? But, you know, I don't like celebrity endorsements. I think they're, if people are swayed by someone who sings for a living, their political acumen on judging who you vote for, I think maybe that that voter is a little naive and can be bought. So again, that's something that we can discuss later, but I'm just throwing my name out there and my hat in the ring that I am open to celebrity endorsements or quasi important radio endorsements. And my price is only $1,000. Another aspect that I wanted to talk about is the emotional and psychological lightweights that have hit the country's airwaves since the election. What do I mean by that? I mean celebrities or commentators who cry on air or have issues about, you know, their candidate and their candidate leaving. Losing. Jimmy Kimmel cried during a late night show when he called the election night a terrible night for many of the election blocks, but he actually cried on the air. CBS's John Dickerson choked up on the late night show on a post-election appearance. The View, the perennial favorite of many on the left, has been profoundly disturbed by the outcome of the election almost every day on every show. MSNBC analyst and former United States Senator Claire McCaskill cried while watching the Harris concession speech on air. MSNBC's Joy Reid, who is not joyful at all lately, has blasted white women for the election outcome, but she keeps complaining about the electorate and how they let her down and how they let the American public down by not voting for Kamala Harris. That is a consistent theme with her show. CNN's John Acosta was scolded the Latino Trump voters for voting against their own self-interest, basically shooting your foot off despite your leg kind of routine. But again, it's a whole litany of pundits and people who are kind of bemusing themselves, saying that they're crying on air, complaining about the electorate. And as the election, there's always candidates and politicians who were running for office and maybe not running for office. And what they're putting on digital media right now is that the fascists have won. So, you know, I gave you an examples of seven or eight things that some of these candidates have been saying and some of the pundits have been saying about the candidates who failed. But again, just like baseball, there is no crying in politics. I just don't understand the kind of posturing that some of these pundits do on air. I don't like the crying. I don't think late night TV hosts should be crying on air. I mean, the reason we go to late night TV is to be relieved of the day-to-day pressures of our day-to-day lives. It is not to relive the experience. And it's funny, one of the CNN commentary roundtables was discussing the role of comedians in the role of politics. And some of the comedians that were on there tried to justify that they were allowed to talk politics because it's a free country. That is true, but your bread and butter is with comedy. It is not with politics. If we pay you for politics, that's fine. If we pay you for comedy, that's fine. Just like people in their occupations. If we pay you to be a truck driver, be a truck driver. If we pay you to be a brain surgeon, be a brain surgeon. But when you're out of your lane, you're out of your lane and you shouldn't be crying out of that lane. But the bigger question that concerns a lot of these pundits is whether, you know, these pundits are either crying or disturbed about the election, is that they always posit the question, what is wrong with America? And why did the post-election outcome of Kamala Harris losing, what is wrong with America for voting this way? Well, this really begs these answers to that question. Is the American electorate just dumb and uneducated? Two, has the American electorate been manipulated by the message of the candidates or by the media? Three, has there been a collective sickness or lethargy among certain parts of the electorate who really don't care and don't vote correctly? I put correctly in quotes. It's an electorate that really doesn't care about right or wrong, or it's an electorate with hidden biases and prejudices that affect their voting, or is it a massive coordinated propaganda machine orchestrated by the media? All of these potential answers on what's wrong with America because they didn't vote my way opens up a can of worms. All these possibilities are troubling. From dumb and dumber to an all-powerful and bitter manipulation machine, it's generally kind of a dystopian kind of future for America. The explanation is interesting, and they point in a certain direction. There is a premise that seems to be from these democratic processes that any case against democracy can be made by those five arguments. Well, again, there's always another question that the case against democracy is to just talk to a typical voter for 5 minutes. The assumption is they don't know what they're doing. They're dumb, uneducated, unable to make a logical and consistent vote, and unable to make a vote that betters society and betters themselves at the same time. So is the electorate either dumb or manipulated? Remember, the premise against this type of democracy, just talking to an average voter for 5 minutes, or they're too dumb to vote correctly, is really for autocracy and for a different type of government. When you make arguments that the electorate is dumb, it is a case for an autocrat and someone in power. So only this time, in this election, the case is being made by the party that lost and an autocracy that didn't happen on the Democratic side. Now, whether one happens on the Republican side with a, you know, maybe an imperial empowered Trump taking office from both sides of Congress on his side, we'll wait and see. But it's so funny how autocracy, the line between autocracy and democracy, is so fine and so fuzzy that it is generally crossed routinely by both parties in criticizing the other party, criticizing the electorate, or just plain mad about the outcome of the election. We're going to take a quick break in here right now. We hope you really frequent our sponsors, and we'll be right back on the street right after these messages.
Paul Oster, certified FICO Pro, the nation's credit repairman and the president of Better Qualified. 20 years of helping thousands of people just like you repair their credit. We have an A rating with the Better Business Bureau, and our clients have saved thousands of dollars with lower interest rates. We're currently helping people in your area, so take the first step. We have helped our clients to have hundreds of thousands of late payments, collections, and charge-offs deleted from their credit reports. Are you tired of getting denied? Tired of higher interest rates? This is your message. You can own a home. You can get out of debt. You can afford that new car. 20 years later, you have my word. If you're ready to help yourself, I know we will help you, and I'll guarantee it. Text the message CURB to the number 40691. Again, text the message CURB to the number 40691 for your free consultation and credit analysis.
Welcome back, everyone, in the streets. I'm your driver today, your designated driver, Steve Carvelli for Street and Curb. Again, we're talking politics. We're talking post-election, post-mortem, hangover, whatever you want to call it. We'll spend another couple minutes on this today, maybe touching on it next week, but hopefully start looking towards the future and kind of ending the post-election coverage next week. There is another issue I wanted to talk about. It's the power of incumbency. And it's really significant on how certain media play up to incumbent people, people in politics who have been in office for a while. Just as an FYI, Nancy Pelosi won her 20th election to Congress over this past election cycle. Now, the terms are 2 years, but still, it comes out to 40 years in Congress for the United States of America. I got to be honest with you, the chances of me doing something for 40 years in my life are slim and none at this point in my life, and I've never done anything for 40 years. I find it hard to believe that you're, you know, on the public, payroll for 40 years, but it's happening a lot on both sides of the aisle. We've had some on the Republican side retire, but the power of incumbency is tangible, it's real, and I do think it affects a little bit of outcome and how things go along. So, Charles, what is potentially the power of incumbency? Well, number one, you get better exposure to media because half the time you're talking, you may be running for re-election, but you're always using another guise and I'm a current office holder. You have better fundraising capabilities because you have better control of the people who deal with government and service the government. You have also the ability to get more support from donors because, again, you've got the pulpit. It's kind of like a taxpayer and electorate subsidized pulpit effect. You act as an official capacity, but a lot of times you are politicking. Now, that's not allowed. It's not permitted. You're not allowed to send out fundraising material from the over office. But again, if you're in a lower state or local position, I think that line has crossed a lot of times. So it is very difficult to dislodge an incumbent like Nancy Pelosi, who is pretty much entrenched in all forms of government in her jurisdiction, knows everybody, knows every donor, knows every media player, and pretty much controls the electorate because they control the message that comes out of her office. So dislodging an incumbent is like moving a very large rock. It takes a lot more effort and a lot of resources than just moving into a vacant space. So, you know, incumbency is like big rocks. They sit there, they get larger in life, they have a lot of power, and it's getting, the more they sit there, the more and more difficult it is to move it. So again, you know, what happens with the argument of incumbency? It kind of gets paired with term limits. Term limits have been taking front and center because Biden proposed term limits for the Supreme Court. But, you know, I want to talk about term limits non-Supreme Court. You know, there's an argument for term limits have always resonated in the founders of our country. It goes in conjunction with checks and balances that was originally envisioned. And, you know, for this country, we have become more of a functioning hybrid of that right now. But again, it's interesting to talk about term limits for all types of government offices. You know, the president, the 22nd Amendment pretty much limited presidential term limits. It's kind of like a fallback from the FDR extension of his terms. So the 22nd Amendment kind of put the term limits on the presidential side. But even that, believe it or not, was challenged by Reagan. Reagan thought that the term limits, forced term limits from the 22nd Amendment, infringed on the democratic rights of the populace to vote for an elected official. He believed that term limits are an infringement on our democratic rights. Even Bill Clinton suggested in an interview with Rolling Stone that the 22nd Amendment be changed to not be in effect because of life expectations are longer right now. He felt that if people live longer, that term limits shouldn't apply because they can serve longer. So it's kind of interesting. Who would have thought that Clinton would actually support for a person like Trump to have an extension of power? And what's interesting is Clinton didn't think that if you were running for office and you, in other words, like Trump did, ran for office, run for president, lost one term, and then come back another, that term limits wouldn't apply to non-consecutive terms. So if Trump wanted to run again in the next cycle, he believed that the 22nd Amendment should be repealed to allow that. It's interesting. Bill Clinton and Trump as strange bedfellows indeed, but both of them somehow feel that term limits should be passed. You know, even Trump has echoed a lot of these term limits as part of his populist theme. Throughout history, term limits have been suggested as a preventive for concentrated power, corruption, foreign power interference. These are all issues that still resonate today in the digital world. We're concerned about cyber attacks from Russia, China, bad actors in Nigeria, North Korea, wherever they may be, but they're always looking at concentrations of power and being able to affect those concentrations of power. Believe it or not, the Articles of Confederation originally had term limits for representatives for three terms. That would have been 6 years total. That idea was abandoned when the Constitution was put together. It wasn't included in the Constitution. So the original founders always envisioned a rotation in office that elected people would return to the private domain from which they were selected to serve. And it's kind of like an interesting part that this has not played a lot in everyone's populist circles, but it is getting play now. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be right back. We'll finish up on term limits, talked a little bit more about what we're going to talk about with the election, but we're going to take a quick break for the street. We'll be right back after these messages.
Paul Oster, certified FICO Pro, the nation's credit repairman, and the president of Better Qualified. 20 years of helping thousands of people repair their credit. We have an A rating with the Better Business Bureau, and our clients have saved thousands of dollars with lower interest rates. Text the message CURB to the number 40691. Again, text the message CURB to the number 40691 to get your free credit analysis.
Welcome back, everyone in the street. I'm your designated driver today, Steve Carvelli, and you are on Street and Curb in fine radio stations everywhere around the country. So we were talking about term limits, and you know, there's always two sides to every equation. You know, term limits, do they really prevent the corruption of power in concentrated terms that people extend their terms and use the power of incumbency to potentially be swayed by outside actors and possibly entrench themselves to the detriment of public good? Or is term limits just a impediment to our democratic rights to elect who we want to elect? You know, it's a fine line there. You know, whether the risk of entrenched power and possible corruption, quote, Trump, our intended personal democratic rights, and I use Trump in the word of no pun intended, just as a verb, you know, that'll be up for debate. But for me personally, I do believe in term limits for all branches of government except one, the Supreme Court. When the founding people got together in this country, they really wanted to have an independent and impartial which is questionable today because everyone has a political persuasion, even judges. They did not want the judicial to have any influence or undue influence from other forms of government, not only outside actors that we have to be concerned about, but pressures from the executive and the legislative branch. So I do believe in term limits for every other office, even the local offices, because I think in local offices, the power of incumbency is even more entrenched and has more control of the purse strings and the control of the democratic process. But when it comes to the Supreme Court, it should be kept independent. It should not have term limits. Hopefully, Supreme Court judges know when they should retire, if they're being impacted by health issues or when they just want to do something else. I mean, hopefully we've chose the right people and the judges know what their limitations are physically, but they should not be pressured and they should not have any influence of a term limit on how they would vote and how they would view things. Because I do think, just like an elected official, when you're up on a term limit, you feel a little more freer to decide things or institute your proposals. But as a judge, I think you may be forced to make decisions you wouldn't otherwise make at that point. If you're up on a term limit and you know that you may be a sway vote, maybe you're going to change your opinion on that or vote some way that you would have otherwise not voted and not made the decision if you didn't have term limits. So, you know, term limit argument, I'm in full agreement with. I think it's a great populist tool. I think Trump is right on the term limit issue. I think that Biden's perception of putting term limits on as the Supreme Court is problematic and probably should not be done. And that goes hand in hand about adding more members to the Supreme Court, packing the Supreme Court, because frankly, you may not like the decisions being made by the Supreme Court, but it doesn't mean you change the structure of the Supreme Court to suit your needs. The founding peoples in this country were smart. They were much smarter than I think people realize. Some of the tenets and aspects and concepts that they've had, I think, survived the test of time, survived the duration of living longer, survived the hybridization that this country has done. But I think the founding people in this country were smart. And I think making a truly independent Supreme Court is probably the smartest thing that they've done. Checks and balances are important. The three branches of government are important. But I think an independent Supreme Court and how it's been institutionalized and how the Constitution has been formulated to treat the independence of the Supreme Court is very important. So again, when we talk about term limits and we talk about incumbency, old age, corruption, interference, all reasonable categorizations of that discussion. But I think it's kind of funny when we talk about that life expectancy now enters the equation, that the longer we live, the longer we should be able to hold office. Well, you know, not all the times that I don't think the founding people in this country realized that just because you live older doesn't mean you're living better. And if we just take a look at the Biden escapades, the old age escapades, and even the Mitch McConnell old age escapades, when he kind of froze in a speech and couldn't speak anymore, you have to look at that old age and getting older. And just by the science has made us be able to live longer doesn't mean we're living better and doesn't mean we're better qualified to make decisions as elected officials. So I think that whole argument, just because that Clinton made, that the older we are and we should be allowed to run longer, is not true. I mean, there's a time for everything. It is the theme song for this show that, you know, there's a time for things and when to be elected, there's a time for things to go back to the public domain. So I think the public domain is very important. And I think our elected officials have not been really understanding that, you know, these are temporary services that they provide the country. They are not permanent. You do not make a job of being in office. And I think that anyone who thinks that is either in office and doesn't want to leave, but, you know, it works itself down from the presidential level all the way down to a local level for mayor or council or Department of Education or school board, whatever it may be. Term limits should be for everything. Serving the public should be a temporary thing, and everyone should go back to the private domain when they are term limited or elected out. We're going to take a quick break. We'll bring this to a quick close today. We'll see everyone next week. We'll be right back. We're taking a quick break. Welcome back, everyone, to Street and Curve. We've had a full show today. We talked a lot about term limits, incumbency, crying in politics, crying on the air. But I kind of want to close today with a little different note. We're going to start looking forward to the next administration. And it's something that we're going to discuss, of course, on Street and Curb, because that's what we discuss on Street and Curb. So we're going to have some discussions coming up about the role of the president, the role of the president when he has both sides of Congress, if it's an imperial presidency, if it's just a mandated presidency. But one thing that's interesting with this new president Trump coming in is that he has the elected mandate that he won the popular vote. So if you remember back in the day when Trump won the first time, that he didn't win the popular vote. As a matter of fact, Republicans generally don't win the popular vote, but they win the Electoral College. But it's interesting now that he has the popular vote. He has the Senate. Pretty much depending on who you talk to, he has the House of Representatives. So we may see a new type of presidency with a little more autocratic tendencies and a little more imperial tendencies that we're used for in Biden. But that may not be a bad thing, because I think our foreign view, how other countries and agitated people who are do not like us and bad actors who do not like us as a country may have a different viewpoint and maybe a little more tough love towards them. And I think that may be good for the country. Now, you know, we're going to have a lot of talk about tariffs and whether they're inflationary or not. But, you know, we're turning a page here, and maybe it's a page not only in a new party, but it's going to be a page on the type of governance that we're having. And of course, we're going to have the, you know, the resistance and the dissenters. But, you know, that's what we talk here at Street and Curb. We want to be able to look at both sides of the equation, both sides of the issue, cut through the disinformation and be able to see what our path forward is and how it affects us. So I want to have all of you join us next week here for Street and Curb, where we meet on the street. We have a lot of stations carrying our show now. We're going to have more in the new year, but we just have a lot coming, and we have a lot more exciting guests coming on. We have a lot more, some locations we're going to come to. So again, we're in our infancy. We are not mainstream. We are new. We are a radio startup, as they say, but again, startups are fun, and there's no holds barred with us. So we have a lot to do and a lot of heavy agenda to cover for America. So join us next week. We'll meet on the street again, same time, same channel, depending on your location. But again, we'll see you next week. And I'm your host, Steve Carvelli. Happy driving, safe driving. We'll see you then.
Turn, turn, turn. There is a season. Turn, turn.